dab in between what experts like to call the Gen X and millennial generations, I've always considered myself a member of the Oregon Trail generation. No, not that Oregon Trail, the blisteringly hard route from the Midwest to the West that claimed so many lives in the 19th century, but rather a video game by the same name created by the Minnesota Educational Computing Consortium in the late 20th century and bundled into just about every computer sold to a school in the United States in the 1980s and 90s, and I believe truly came to define my generation. Because when we were kids, we played a lot of video games. Starting with the very basic games like Oregon Trail and Lemonade Stand on school computers, but soon thereafter, thanks to the Atari 2600 and the original Nintendo, expanding and evolving right into our living rooms, reaching its climactic height, at least in my neighborhood, with the Super Mario Brothers franchise. Now, the magic of a good video game versus a bad one was the balance of complexity of the game versus how hard it was to win. That is to say, if a game was just too complex to ever have a chance of winning, it was no fun to play. But likewise, if it was too easy, what was the point? And for me, at least, a lot of the games were just too hard. They took weeks, weeks of committed play to master and explore enough to complete. And let's face it, as a child, that was not me, even when it came to video games. But it turned out that the makers of these games had buried within them what we now call Easter eggs, secret passcodes, hidden rooms, things that didn't appear to be a part of the game, but if used correctly, completely transformed the entire experience. The most famous of these deeply embedded secrets, at least in my world, was a passcode known as up, up, down, down, left, right, start. That is like, I mean, I'll remember that one on my grave. In an age before the internet, this top secret and game-altering code was passed on merely by word of mouth, and when executed with your controller at the proper time and place across many different games, the maneuver would unlock incredible possibilities, like adding 99 lives so you were effectively unstoppable, or granting you the use of a deus ex machina-like super weapon that overwhelmed all your enemies, or simply by opening up warp zones that allowed you to skip huge portions of the game altogether. And for this reason, the code also became known as easy mode. Because when the code was entered, it rebalanced the playing field so far to the player's advantage that the game became almost boringly easy. As I got older and discovered other interests, video games slowly melted to the background and took on a much less significant part of my life. Parents of teens, I assure you this too will happen to yours. But the metaphor of easy mode stuck with me, because that's what my life felt like at times. While I certainly struggled mightily in some subjects in school and had to work hard to be competitive on the track team, it just seemed like I had some magic going for me that protected me from anything too bad ever happening. This magic was especially evident when I made a big mistake, like the time I've talked about before from this pulpit when, towards the end of high school, I found myself in the wrong place at the wrong time with a bag of definitely not medicinal marijuana. But like most other problems I ran into, this one just seemed to solve itself. Why, the judge seemed almost embarrassed to have wasted my parents' time with the proceedings, and that was that. Back to my nice little life, without as much as a slap on the wrist. Around that time, although I didn't realize a shift had occurred, that previously held notion of easy mode transformed in my head to a new idea. Magic Jeremy. There was obviously something very special about me. My path was laid out so perfectly that even when I fell from it, I magically reappeared right where I had left off without a scratch.
And you're very modest.
And I'm modest. Magic Jeremy strikes again, I would think. And this, my friend, is how white privilege is born. How it manifests within our well-meaning minds and bodies, and how easy it is for it to be silently perpetuated. Because, if we're being honest here, it turns out I wasn't magic or even particularly special. It turns out I was white. And let's be honest, in 21st century America, nothing is as magical as being white. It makes you richer. It makes you healthier. It increases your job prospects and life expectancy for no other reason than the color of your skin. So, in a way, I was correct. I was protected by a magic spell called whiteness. That, well, it didn't assure me of any one thing for sure, but it certainly tilted all the scales in my favor. So that when I wanted something, I was pretty likely to get it. Whether it was acceptance to a good college or a job or an internship. And if I made a mistake, the consequences were very unlikely to be long-term or catastrophic. Because the world I live in is built for me. All the structures were created and are maintained by people who have lived a life like mine. Like the white male judge who was too understanding to trouble my family with even a basic penalty for my having been arrested for being out late on a school night with a bag of illegal drugs. Or the white male college admittance counselor who could overlook my less than perfect grades for the potential he saw in me, in no small part, because unconsciously or otherwise, I reminded him of me. I finally woke up to the ways I was benefiting from white supremacy sometimes in seminary, when I was uncomfortably forced by my coursework, environment, and desire to become a UU minister. Since that time, a decade and a half ago, I've embarked on a journey of painful inner work that will never be complete, to face the racism that lives within me, and to intentionally learn how to overcome its unconscious power over me. It's work that I will never fully complete, but that I'm dedicated to as a core part of my spiritual calling and practice. And currently, the term white supremacy is being used in a lot of conversations throughout our Unitarian Universalist denomination. And for a lot of us UU white folk, it's a hard term to hear when the finger is being pointed at us, because we like to think of ourselves as the ones who get it when it comes to race, right? So it's important for me to talk about that term for a minute, because the way we're using white supremacy is not meant to describe individuals acting consciously to keep white people in control and power. We're not talking about the KKK here. Rather, we're using it to describe the way white privilege gets baked into systems and into structures so deeply that we lose sight of it, yet it continues to help perpetuate within us that which we're attempting to vanquish. And this is the kind of white supremacy we're talking about in our denomination right now. About 2 weeks ago, a hiring decision was announced within the UUA for the Southern Regional Leadership position, and the choice was a white man, meaning that it would leave the proportion of leads at 13 out of 14 positions held by white people, 20 years after a very public commitment by the denomination to more diversity in leadership. To make matters more concerning, the person who was not chosen in the final round, a woman of color, was told that she was not the right fit. A term all too familiar to people of color trying to break into culturally white organizations and understood as code for, you're not white. A classic case of white supremacy. The accusation is not that people consciously did anything wrong, but rather to point out that the hiring process itself continues to not see qualified people of color as the right fit, because unconsciously their idea of fit is itself deeply rooted in the white culture of the UUA. And in this case, it was the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back and that launched 1,000 Facebook posts. In the 2 weeks since this story broke, its shockwaves have reverberated throughout our denomination. A few days after initially offering a rather defensive response to the controversy, the UUA president, Peter Morales, resigned his position 3 months before the end of his second term. Shortly thereafter, two other high-ranking UUA staff involved in the hiring decision resigned their positions as well. Now, it feels useful to contrast these current events with the much more distant ones that formed the flower communion that we will celebrate today. Created in a Unitarian church in Prague, then of Czechoslovakia, just before the first shots of World War II rang out, as Unitarian scholar Reginald Zottoli wrote, "The significance of the flower communion is that as no two flowers are alike, So no two people are alike, yet each has a contribution to make. Together, the different flowers form a beautiful bouquet. Our common bouquet would not be the same without the unique addition of each individual flower, and thus it is with our church community. It would not be the same without each and every one of us. And a lot of people are still missing from our bouquet. So if this service is a statement of our community, one of the things it reminds us is that we're not there yet. From the beginning, our message has been one of not just mere tolerance and acceptance, but of radical inclusion. And not just because it's some kind of lofty ideal, but because in very real and practical ways, it serves us all the best. We all prosper when we join forces. We grow in beauty, in knowledge, in ability, in strength, when we grow in diversity. Each of us has a contribution to make, and this world would not be the same without each and every one of us. But just as the flower communion was created by a straight, white, male-bodied person, so was much of the early Unitarian and Universalist church structure. Our polity and bylaws were all conceived of and codified by white men, out of the limits of their imagination and knowledge, without much, if any, contribution from women, people of color, the LGBT community, or people with mental and physical challenges. And so they created a culture that reflected their narrow understanding of the values they were setting forth to live religiously. Over my 6+ years here, I've spoken many times about my personal theology, process thought, and its understanding that the present moment is merely a creative reshuffling of all that came before, and that we humans are co-creators with God, and that we get to decide how each new moment comes into being, what becomes actual, and what remains an unborn possibility. And this has deep implications for structures and systems like the ones we're talking about. It basically tells us that without a great deal of intentionality, the most likely outcome is to keep recreating the same patterns over and over again. It's what we're prone to do, return to familiarity whether it serves us or not. And what the UUA is best at still is serving white culture. Not because it's full of bad people with bad intentions that don't like people who are not white, but because of a failure of intentionality. Because we have failed to properly check our systems and structures for the very assumptions of white supremacy we've been trying to work against. And while we weren't paying attention, it crept into our hiring practices, into our assumptions about who to market Unitarian Universalism to, into our thoughts on where to start new churches, on our ideas about how to support new ministers and ministries in formation, and so much else. I have heard here in this very congregation statements like, Unitarian Universalism really only appeals to people with a Western background, or that we are up against a demographic challenge here in Fremont as a Unitarian Universalist congregation. To me, consciously or not, these are at some level codes for the idea that Unitarian Universalism is a white person's religion. And personally, I see absolutely no reason for that. Beyond the many non-white people that have found happy homes here and in other UU congregations, our message is literally intended to appeal across culture, race, ethnicity, gender, class, sexuality, age, and education. Difference is our thing, and yet we remain a majority white denomination. In response to the resignation of UUA President Peter Morales, the UUA board announced what I think is a beautiful short-term solution to our leadership opening. They announced a very un-Unitarian trinity of co-presidents to see us through the less than 3 months until our regularly scheduled presidential election this summer at GA. I won't bore you with the details, although I'll put more information on our Facebook page and in the Week on the Peak, but these three co-presidents have been chosen with the hopes that they will use this window to begin moving an agenda forward that will require our denomination to take what sounds kind of like a racism audit and to begin making recommendations for best practices in some specific areas like hiring. Today, I call on this congregation to use some of the next 2-year interim ministry period to do some similar inner work, to ask questions of yourselves like, why, in a community as diverse as Fremont, is Mission Peak always had a straight white man as a settled minister? And what are the ways that our message of radical inclusion can be better shared with our neighbors, whoever they may be? How have we set up our culture to be radically welcoming, and where is it still falling short? How are our music practices, worship style, and outreach efforts contributing to our work against who we are? How are they contributing to, and how are they working against what we're trying to be? May we be willing to ask these tough questions of our own structures and systems and of ourselves. And may we continue to move closer towards the world we dream of. May it be so. Amen.